13th. It's about 3:20 now. We're going to take these slightly out of order, do the work session on the three bills that we intend to send to the House Health and Human Services Committee without reference first, and then we'll get into the public hearing on House Bill 3624. So I'll open a work session on House Bills 2189.
One at a time.
Okay.
Okay.
And
we'll appreciate it if you do it that way.
All right. I'm getting coached here, and I appreciate the coaching. Let me make one statement first. Probably all of you know by now that our chair, Ben Westland, is got some health issues, is going to be undergoing surgery and treatment, and we all miss him, and we're going to carry on as best we can without him. And with that, I will turn to Representative Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 89, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Cruz moves that House Bill 2189 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation, and then to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Mm-hmm.
Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Ordered. I open a hearing on House Bill 2537.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cruz.
Yeah. First off, Mr. Chair, could you close the work session on the first bill?
Oh, I'd be happy to close that session.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2537 be referred to the House Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation, with a prior referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative
subsequent referral.
Representative Cruz moves that House Bill 2537 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation, and then to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. And I'll close the
hearing. I'm glad I'm not the only one serving an apprenticeship this year.
I will close the hearing on House Bill 25, work session on 2537, and I'll open a work session on 2641.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 2641 be referred to the committee, the House Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation, and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Cruz moves that House Bill 2641 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation, and then to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2641. Well, this is the most bills we moved out of this committee. We haven't gotten any practice in that. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3624. And could we have Holly step up and give us a brief overview and let us know what the Dash 4s do compared to where we were.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council.
Holly.
What?
You got to pull it closer. There you go.
You think I would have learned by now how close I have to be to this microphone. For the benefit and part of the committee members that have not been as intimately and daily involved in this conversation, I will go over the bill sort of its entirety, and as I do it quickly, I will highlight the changes between the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s. I believe you have in front of you both the Dash 4s as well as a summary dated today, I think, that has bullets on the side. The Section 2 of the bill has the definitions that apply throughout the new provisions of the bill. There is a new definition in here, and it is a definition of fully capitated health plan, which is Section 2, Subsection 3, because the term is used so much in the bill. And what it does is parallel the structure that Bill uses in defining physician care organization, but in the case of a fully capitated health plan, it provides all of the services that are described in 414705, which is the complete list of services that are provided under the health plan. Section 3 of the bill requires persons who are eligible for medical assistance to enroll in a prepaid managed care plan. The requirement for enrollment in a plan applies to physical health, dental health, mental health, and chemical dependency first. And there are two exceptions to this rule, which are found in subsections 2 and 3 of the bill. Section 2 exempts certain persons, and the list of those persons are on lines 16 to through the end of that page. These are individuals either by federal law or under the discretion of the department should not be placed in a or should have not be required to go into a fully capitated health plan. And then on page
Mr.
3.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Holly, how come you use 18 in one line and 19 in the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, as I understand it, there are different programs that grew up differently, that serve different clientele, and in one group, and I'm hoping I'm getting nods behind me, in the old SCF group, they actually can stay through their 18th birthday, and in the mentally fragile unit, those kids, once they turn 18, are no longer eligible. Did I do okay? Am I getting nods back there? Good.
Not a single one.
Blanks.
Blanks. That's okay. I think it's flat line. That's what that works, too.
There,
I just
fine.
Don't want to look like... And Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, in fact, it's because I got asked to change one and not change the other. So I assumed one was correct and one was incorrect.
And Ms. Chair, I'd point out that basically this list came from OMAP, so we have a reasonable comfort level not only in what's in the list, but the language that allows other things to be included as needed.
Right. Thank you.
They're actually different federally driven programs is actually the bottom line. Subsection 3 of Section 3, which appears on the top of page 3, is the other exception to the rule of mandatory enrollment in some kind of capitated plan. And what subsection 3 says is if there is a plan, and it might be a physical health plan, a dental health plan, a mental health plan, or a chemical dependency plan, is not able to serve additional enrollees, and the person would receive those services from a fee-for-service payment provider. But we've sort of broken this up into four doors to make it sure or to differentiate between physical health, dental health, mental health, and chemical dependency to make it clear that each one starts as a capitated plan. Then if there are not services available, then you can go into fee-for-service. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for questions here.
Makes sense to me.
Section 4... directs the department, modifies current law, and modifies the department to use prepaid managed health care plans to the greatest extent possible for those four separate subject areas and gives the department discretion to use the fee-for-service payment system where the plan is not able to serve additional clients. Section 5 and Section 5A have been amended since the Dash 3s. Section 5 now deals with those situations where the department is not able in a designated area to contract with a fully capitated health plan and allows a physician care organization, which is basically an entity that provides all services except for inpatient hospital services to in those areas, contract with the department. It also gives the Office for Health Policy and Research the authority or the directive to establish the requirements that the department must use when they are making their discretionary decision whether or not to contract with a physician care organization in a particular area. The bill does include some specific requirements for the office to consider or to wrap into their criteria, and those are found on page 5, lines 8 through 17.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Holly, two follows differently than one, but one seems to say that if the department is able to contract with a fully capitated health plan or plans in an area, it may not then contract with a for the physician care organization. That's certainly not the intent, is it? I mean, if there's in a large community, it might not be the intent.
Say that again.
Well, in a large community, the department may be able to contract with a fully capitated health plan for a component of the population, but the fully capitated health plan might not be able to manage the whole population. Would one allow the circumstances where the department might contract with one or more fully capitated health plans and with a PCO in the same county?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bates,
that was a large point of consternation for the committee when we worked this. The answer is yes, you can. If you look on page 5, line 11 through 13. We put a line in there saying that you can do that, but you have to prove that it does not risk the financial stability or any other factors that might affect an F-chip going down. So you can do a PCO, but only if you're not affecting an F-chip at the same time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, what we took away, and I think part of the confusion, is that originally it said that there was not capacity to grow. And in that case, that language, because of the number of problems it caused, was removed. But if the department is looking to increase services, and I mean they have a contract out, and there's not a contract, there's not a F-chip that wants to contract, they say we don't want to, or whatever the circumstances is, but whatever they have done that would say there's nobody out there that wants to contract with us as an F-chip, regardless of the circumstances, then the PCO becomes an option. So there's no limitation in here that says that they could not under those circumstances.
But
I guess the answer is they can.
Sub 1 and sub 2 are separate. I mean, they're not. It's not an and or anything. And there, I mean,
no, there's an and.
No.
Between sub 1 and sub 2.
Well, the criteria.
Section 5.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, the office is going to develop these criteria that then the department has to apply.
Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out, and Holly's right. I mean, this is Uber's gonna set the bar, but it is our intention and the intention of this legislation that the bar be relatively high, because we want F-chips every place that is possible to have them. And so the bar is going to be relatively high, but it's not going to be so high that if an F-chip isn't going to be available, that a PCO would be excluded.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess we're in work session here, is that right? I mean,
no,
can we talk to each other? Is that? Sub 1 says that the department, if it has not been able to contract, may contract with a PCO. It seems, and then it says, here's the conditions under which you might. One might infer from this that if the department has been able to contract with a PCO in a designated area, it may not contract. If the department has been able to contract with a fully capitated health plan, let's say in Multnomah County, then it may not. I mean, this does not give it the authority, I think, therefore, to also contract with a PCO.
Representative Bates.
Representative Greenleaf, when we wrote the language, we did not want to put in anything other than that we're not prescribing them from getting involved with the PCO under the conditions you're talking about. If you look at subsection 2, it says the criteria developed by the office shall include, but not limited to the following, okay? What we're trying to do here, we chose not to put language in that said that you can't have a PCO if you have an F-chip available, okay? We also tried to protect the F-chips as much as we could in doing that. So there's nothing here that prescribes them from doing exactly what you're saying, because that's going to happen, we think. There will be situations in which you might have one, two, or even three F-chips functioning in a designated area and a PCO happening there at the same time. And there's nothing here that says you can't do that. You might infer that, but there's nothing that says you can't do it. What we wanted was criteria saying if you are going to go to that PCO, you have to do the following, but you may have other criteria to decide on also.
Well, let me ask the LC. Is that your reading for the record?
Yes.
That
and
was my
if,
question?
If over time, I mean, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, like, if over time it doesn't, we've been looking at these same words for a long time. If over time it doesn't say what we think it says, then there'll be an opportunity to fix them. But I think that in the situation that you've described, this would give the department discretion if they want.
That's all I was asking. Thank you. Please continue.
Section 5A is a new section, and in some ways there's a distinction between the distinction between Section 5 and Section 5A is what we talked about as the difference between startups, so to speak, and then those FCHIPs that want to convert to a physician care organization and in a particular area or in a new area go from providing FCHIP services to PCO services. So Section 5A addresses those situations where you have a fully capitated health plan that wishes to contract for PCO services either in its own designated area or in a different designated area and gives the department discretion to pursue that as well. And again, the Office for Health Plan Policy and Research would have authority to develop the criteria.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just point out this was a key point in the last days of working this bill with Representative Westland, and we agreed with him that that we needed to be clear and distinct between creation and conversion, and we also needed to be clear and distinct that the bar will be relatively high for creation but even higher for conversion, and so that's why it was split up and why it's worded this way.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 6 of the bill addresses the situation of a current prepaid group health plan, group practice health plan that wants to contract with the department to provide limited services and this to provide services less than fully capitated health plan services, and this gives the department the directive to contract to provide those services. Section 7 modifies or clarifies actually the definition of health services that is used throughout those Oregon laws that address services under the Oregon Health Plan, and they basically specify that prescription drugs are one of the services that are provided. Clearly, since the health plan started, it has been assumed that they were provided because they're providing them, but this makes it clear that, in fact, they are one of the covered services. Section 8 does a number of things. It requires the Health Services Commission, when they're putting their list together, to consider the clinical effectiveness and cost effectiveness of health services using peered review literature. It removes the requirement that an actuary be retained for the commission to determine capitation rates. And finally, it adds a new requirement that the commission solicit as well testimony and information from representatives of commercial carriers and representatives of small and large Oregon employers who also clearly have a stake in the Oregon Health Plan.
Thank you. Thank you. You did very well.
Thank you. Section 9 of the bill has not changed since the -3s. This is the section that addresses the new process for establishing both a benchmark for determining or setting capitation rates, and as well as gives the department authority to actually set those rates. This section has not been changed from the -3s. Section 10 of the bill also was not changed. This section directs the department to contract with fully capitated health plans to provide administrative services for some of the health services that are provided for fee-for-service clients. Again, there was one minor change in here. This is on Section 10, Subsection 3, and we added a requirement that these contracts be cost-neutral to the department so that if it appeared that entering into one of these contracts was going to cost the state more money than it was saving, then the department would have authority to not contract.
Thank you.
What?
But thank you.
Section 11 has been significantly changed since the -3s. Section 11 now is the anti-carve-out, as I call it. Currently, as this committee has heard, prescription drugs are carved out of capitation rates and paid on a fee-for-service basis by the department. Section 11 directs the department to contract with fully capitated health plans to provide prescription drugs, except antipsychotic drugs, and establish capitation rates that include payments for these services. Section 12 has also been changed. Section 12 addresses hospitals who serve clients under or enrollees of the health plan, and now says that a hospital may not decline to treat a person who is receiving health services from a fully capitated health plan, that a hospital that does not have a contract must accept reimbursement rates established by the department under Section 9, which is the new rate-setting section, and that a fully capitated health plan may, of course, contract for more or less than those rates if the two parties agree to the contract. Section 13 has not been changed. It addresses the bifurcated pharmacy benefit manager system, and the manager would purchase prescription drugs for the department. It also and directs the PBM to set up two programs, one for the state and one for the fully capitated health plans that choose to participate. And participation by the fully capitated health plans is still discretionary under the bill. That's on page 12 at the top.
So far.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
I know this is an appropriate time to pause and just and cover a couple of issues that we may hear in testimony real quickly, just if Holly would allow that. I don't want to break the chain. You're doing a great job. You're on a real roll. I hate to stop you. Just so committee members that aren't as familiar with the bill as we are know, in Section 12, you may find some controversy about the hospitals being required to accept persons who are under fully capitated health care.
Oh, and it may have to do more with the rates.
Yes, which I refer you back to the previous section that's in which we're trying to be more transparent and have benchmarks for those rates that are Medicare benchmarks, which hopefully will solve the real problem, which is lack of reimbursement. We're trying to bring the capitated health plans and the hospitals together in a fair and equal playing field where they can work out rates together. Whether this bill does that or not is something to be contested between them. I believe it does. They may not, and I recognize that. The other thing it doesn't speak to is A and B hospitals, who have always been paid at full costs. We debated that back and forth in the work group, and I'm open on that question. I don't know how the members feel. And the last part is the requirement in section, lack of requirement in section 13 that fully capitated health plans have to use the statewide pharmacy benefit manager. Whether we should go there or not is still open to discussion, and I'm willing to move you the direction on it, but I want some input from the health plans on it. So those are three areas that we may see a little more movement here on. Just wanted the committee members to be aware of that so that they don't get questions once they leave this room about it and don't understand that it has been a large part of our discussions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. As we do this, you used to do this as a threesome. We're now doing it as a duo, and we'll try to fill in that empty void as we go. But it was our intent, clearly, to set a non-discretionary, non-prejudicial benchmark in Section 9, and we think we have done that. Where we may not have quite connected is to make sure that the reimbursement rates are equal as the benchmarks are. And so we may need to be looking at some language there. Clearly our intention was as you marry Section 9 to Section 12, our assumption in all of this was that if we have set appropriate reimbursement rates, that if a FCHIP is contracted with a hospital for that reimbursement rate, a hospital that's not under contract should accept the same reimbursement rate. And where we may have dropped the ball here a little bit is we may have still allowed unintended flexibility to allow fee-for-service reimbursement rates to still be in play. It's not our intention, and we will make sure that the language speaks to that. The reason we eliminated reference to A and B hospitals in here is we assumed that they're already covered in statute. Now, we may need to put in language that says notwithstanding, you know, just kind of the boilerplate to make sure that it is the clear intent of this legislation not to disturb that set of statutes. So, I mean, you know, our intention has been very clear the whole way through, and our intention will remain the same. We thought we had come up with appropriate language, but we also reserve the right to maybe have not been quite as explicit as we need to be. So, you know, these things will be addressed as this moves forward.
Thank you. Go ahead, Holly.
To finish up then, sections 14, the remainder of the bill has not changed significantly from the dash threes. Well, some of it has, so we'll go through it. 14, 15, and 16 have not changed. 14 directs the department to consult with representatives of the fully capped health plans before they do the RFP for the pharmacy benefit manager contract, and to review with FCHIP some their contracts and changes to decrease costs. Section 15 directs the department to negotiate and enter into agreements with pharmaceutical manufacturers for supplemental rebates, and gives the department discretion to participate in a multi-state prescription drug purchasing pool. Section 16.
Ms. Chair, if I could, just another concern that was expressed to me. In no way is this intended to infringe upon the institutional PBM that currently exists.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Question on that. Does this mean that it's just those that are, would the fee-for-service be eligible at all for this, participate in this pharmacy plan, or is that only for those? Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair?
That specific piece.
What this bill specifically says is we're going to bifurcate this. If things go the way we'd wish them to go, a single PBM would buy for the whole state. The part that would go to the fee-for-service would be eligible to get the significant discounts available, AWP less 15 and possible supplemental rebates. The part that's bifurcated into the fully capitated health plans would get a discount much less than that, based on a bulk purchasing agreement, probably 5 or 6%. And the advantage to the plans would be that the state, is they can then tightly manage that benefit themselves through their own local networks. And that we're trying to get the best out of both worlds as much as we can. We have not found a way to legally, and there may well not be a way legally, to bring in both AWP and supplemental rebates into managed care. We think that's probably not doable the way federal laws are written.
Mr. Chair, even if we could have done it slightly illegally, we would have, but we couldn't even do it slightly illegally.
We really tried a lot of different ways, and we just couldn't get around it.
Okay, well, let's keep us on the legal path here, Holly.
Really not
Mr. Chair, I try my best.
Yes.
The group I've been working with.
You have to remember she's been working with the Three Stooges. No, that makes it difficult.
He said it, not me. Section 16 is kind of the link in part to the additional pieces of this that I think people anticipate coming in terms of modifications of the health plan. What this does is direct the department to adjust the benefit package for individuals that are categorically needy or under GA at this point. Section 17 has been rewritten somewhat significantly, and it removes the requirement that the department verify certain things. They only are now required to fully document, and it also is a little bit more explicit about what it is that they're documenting for people applying for services, and that would be the category of aid or the way in which they're categorically needy, the status of the person as a resident, and then their financial income and resources. And then finally, 18, 19, and 20 are the operative and effective dates of the Act.
Mr. Chair, I'd point out that Section 17 is anticipating additional legislation.
Thank you. Any questions for Holly?
Comment. Okay. You're terrific. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I would ditto that. It's been a real pleasure working with you and putting up with this.
And having to put up with those two, obviously, are a saint.
With no disrespect to your current chair, I'll feel much better, however, when the wheelchair is back.
Yes.
So will we all.
I second that. Okay. We're moving on in the public hearing. And Bruce Bishop, Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
Mr. Chair, this is a House committee, and I just noticed, and we have a 35-25 majority. I'm the only Republican here.
we can call for one if you need.
I'd still be outnumbered. Thanks for pointing that out, Holly.
My pleasure.
We care about health care, Representative.
Well, this bill takes a lot of brain power, so. figure it out for yourselves.
Okay, well, Bruce, I'm sorry for the levity up here at the dais, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. There's much in 3624 that we could support, but we regret that we must register our opposition to the bill because of Section 12. Section 12 contains two detrimental and probably unintended consequences for Oregon hospitals, and these issues have already been discussed among the committee members by Representative Bates and Representative Cruz, and we appreciate their comments in that regard. First of all, Section 12 would mandate that hospitals treat persons, quote, who receive health services, unquote, from a fully capitated health plan, or an FCHP. Under the bill's provisions, this could include not only enrollees, but patients whose claims are processed by an FCHP. More importantly, however, we're aware of no comparable statute in Oregon law where a provider of health or any other service is required to serve all patients or customers. We can see no justification for imposing this obligation on hospitals, but not on physicians or medical clinics or pharmacists or nursing homes. Not only would the bill require that hospitals serve all patients, it would require that hospitals either contract with a fully capitated health plan or accept as payment in full whatever amount the state Medicaid program decides that it wants to or can't afford to pay. Not even the most extreme regulatory scheme for a public utility would contemplate such a requirement. Second, Section 12 could jeopardize the status of small rural hospitals, those hospitals that are currently entitled under state law to cost-based reimbursement. It would do that because it could be read to allow those hospitals to be paid less than their costs if they've not contracted with a fully capitated health plan or with a physician care organization. However, even if they are contracted facilities, the bill might be construed to mean that fully capitated health plans need not pay them their costs, and that's the requirement under current law. On behalf of the Hospital Association, we would respectfully request that Section 12 be removed from the bill in order that Oregon hospitals can continue to be partners with the state in the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Bruce? Representative Merkley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask our experts here on the panel to clarify the situation.
It's like a game show, you know.
Would the star in the white shirt please clarify this for me? If in fact, I am a part of the Oregon Health Plan and I am signed up with a fully capitated health plan that has a contract with Hospital A, not A and B in the context we're talking about, but just a certain hospital, and I decide I'd rather go drive over to Bend and get services with a completely different hospital, is that hospital in Bend now required under this law to provide treatment to me as if it was under contract to the health care, to the plan that I'm signed up under?
Mr. Chair, if this is where the quandary really comes in. If you show up at the other hospital with an emergency condition that must be treated, it's life-threatening, that hospital, by federal law and morally, will do it. They will take you and take care of you. Absolutely will do that. There's never been a question about that in the hospital association. I don't think we disagree with that scenario. The real tough scenario is, and this is the one we're trying to address here, is let's take the Portland area, and you have a fully capitated health plan that has not been able to sign a contract with several of the hospitals that are there. And you have a physician who has a patient needs to be hospitalized. It is not absolutely emergent, but something needs to be hospitalized for. Maybe it's elective surgery or something of that nature. And that hospital says, no, we won't take that patient. And no other hospital will. The fallback position has been that you've had those patients sent to those hospitals and paid what we call a Medicaid rate, which is far below what their costs are. And that's the hospital's difficulty, that the fully capitated plan will simply say, we're not going to bargain in good faith with you, we're just going to give you a Medicaid rate and that's it, and we'll balance our books out on that basis. Fully capped plan's problem is if they haven't got arrangements with those hospitals ahead of time and they get a notice from that hospital saying we're not taking anything but absolute urgent care, then they feel they can't sign the contract either. So you've got two groups here who can't come together to fulfill a contract that we need fulfilled. And so we've tried to address that in this language. We feel that hospitals are obviously going to take care of the emergency cases. They are also in a situation where they are tax-exempt for most part. There are plans out here like the Utah plan where they don't get paid at all for groups outside of the mandated. There are situations where they just about have to take the patient anyway. But we're trying to level the playing field between these two groups. We don't want the hospital to get stuck with just Medicaid rates, but we want to put as much pressure on them as we can to make them sign agreements with fully capped plans. On the other hand, we want the fully capped plans to offer reasonable rates to them. And we've gone back and forth in language in here that was a percentage above Medicaid rates, that was near Medicare rates. We finally left it in this form. I don't think we have much arguing with AB situation as far as those hospitals. We kind of thought that was already covered by statute. But this is a very difficult issue, and that's why we brought it up earlier, and one in which we're trying to bring these two parties together on a fairly level playing field so they can work out arrangements amongst them on what this is going to look like. If we've been unsuccessful in that, which we may be, well, we may have to look at this again, look at the language. But for the time being, it stands until, I hope, it goes to the Senate. There'll be more discussion there. And I am very open to what the hospitals might suggest, other than just taking it out, is maybe potentially different language that would help level this field between these two players so we can keep the F-chips going and make both parties reasonably whole. The real key thing here, as I said earlier, is the amount of money available. And we all have a hand in that. The legislature and the hospitals and the F-chips can all be responsible for bringing down more federal match, which would resolve much of this issue. So you can get a reasonable rate out there, and I think the hospitals will be glad to step up the reasonable rate and work out capitated arrangements.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Just follow up, and I think it would be my preference, Mr. Chair, rather than removing Section 12, that we make sure that Section 9 is very clear as to what reimbursement will be. And so we don't leave the opening for fee-for-service reimbursement rates to even be in play for these clients. And quite clearly, I'm not sure we have got there. But you know, Representative Bates is right. This is clearly a balancing act, and the question is whether we can get there with that language or not. I'm hoping that we can.
Any other comments, Bruce, from you? No? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lynn Reed, OMAP.
She looks familiar.
But I'm not carrying as much.
You aren't. White load today.
You sent the rest over to Central Oregon?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm Lim Reed, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. I'm here to thank you first for the substantive work that has gone into this bill and reflected in the Dash 4 amendments. It's addressed a number of concerns that we've had and requests for clarifications. Most components of the bill are components that we think work. I do want to comment, though, on a few remaining sections of concern in the bill that still pose some problems for us. We do fully support the intent of the bill.
Lynn, this must be a party.
Well, anyway, I think that we're in agreement with you in terms of supporting the intent of the bill and most sections of the bill. In Section 2, I just wanted to make a comment here, which I've made before, that the definition of PCO may limit the entities that would be interested in signing up as a PCO. And I know there is some intent there to do so. Section 3, we do appreciate the flexibility that has been provided.
Chair, Representative Bates.
Lynn, I'm going to go back to this thing on Section 2 just real quick. Are you suggesting that PCOs, potentially some might be exempt from having to manage pharmaceuticals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, what was intending to convey here was that we thought it we might have a better chance of getting a PCO in an area that doesn't have managed care today if the PCO did not have to take risk for prescription drugs. Necessarily manage.
I think I used the wrong term. Taking risk is the key here. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to tell you that a PCO that doesn't take risk for prescription drugs doesn't have much value from my point of view, and I would strongly suggest we not allow that to be part of the bill. I think if you have a PCO that being at risk for prescription drugs is a key part of holding health care costs down. As far as I'm concerned as a state legislature, I don't much like it as a physician, but I like it from this side. And I would strongly oppose that right now. I have a real problem with that.
And I would concur.
Thank you. We haven't talked about this ahead of time, so we agree without.
No.
Moving on to Section 3. we do like the way Section 3 is worded. We do think, however, that the subsection 2, which describes the exemption for a person who is an American Indian or and who is a member of federally recognized tribe, isn't properly inclusive. And we have suggested language here that is the same language that is in Senate Bill 878 that describes the group of American Indians, Alaska Natives, that we would intend be exempt in this category. Skipping all the sections in between, moving to Section 10. just want to point that out. This section does not define administrative services, and so it is our assumption that that the department would have some discretion in determining the administrative functions that would be contracted. And just wanted to clarify that with you.
Let me ask you this question. Do you currently have that discretion, and does this change that at all?
Mr. Chair, we don't currently do what's envisioned in Section 10 in terms of contracting with the fully capitated health plans to manage fee-for-service clients. And so it hasn't really come up, but I think there's a broad range of things that could be included here, just wanted to be sure that the intent is that, knowing that we'll be doing administrative rules, that the intent is to allow for that flexibility.
Mr. Chair, I'd point out that the administrative services will probably be given more detail under an additional piece of legislation still yet to be written fully.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just for other committee members and audience, the purpose of this section is to allow FCHIPS to manage parts of the fee-for-service population, which is a significant change, and shouldn't be just brushed over. It's a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
Something as simple as reviewing emergency room claims and looking at patients who might be using emergency room excessively in fee-for-service and trying to get some control of that is a real significant change, something that local community-based FCHIPS can do a better job of, I believe, than a central bureaucracy, and so just because they're there in the community, and they can do a better job by their location. So it's not in any way critical of OMAP or your agency. It's, we think, potentially a better way to do it, and you have a lot of leeway in arranging for that to happen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just redefine what FCHIP is.
Fully capitated health plan.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, that's not a redefinition. That's just an explanation.
The other comment I'd make on Section 10 deals with the fully capitated health plans managing all prescription drugs except for the antipsychotic drugs, and believe that does limit the flexibility in terms of how the management of those mental health drugs might be configured in the community. It makes an assumption that those, I assume they're primarily antidepressants, but anyway, those non-antipsychotic drugs are best managed by the fully capitated health plan. There may be some other mechanisms that will work within a community involving the mental health organization.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Lynn, I don't think the language precludes an MHO contracting with PBM for purchase of drugs. So, I mean, we had that discussion, and we think the language is flexible enough to allow that to happen.
Thank you. In Section 11, this is the section that, by intent, would prevent the carve-out of prescription drugs from fully capitated health plans, would require us to contract for prescription drugs, including mental health drugs other than antipsychotics. And currently, we do contract with fully capitated health plans with the exception of the mental health drugs. But this takes away the flexibility should the state at some point want to carve out, as has been proposed in some other states, in order to, with the idea being that you might want to try and get the best of both worlds, getting the federal drug rebates by paying in a fee-for-service environment, but finding a way to get the federal government to allow the fully capitated health plans to manage the drug benefit using all of their drug management tools. You know, we haven't found that way yet. It's just that this would preclude going in that direction.
And Mr. Chair, I would point out if at some point in the next century we find that way, we can modify the language of statute to do that. And trust me, we tried to find that way. So.
Thank you. Section 12, in reading the language, the intent was somewhat unclear to me, but I just want a clarification that the intent here is that that we believe is to require hospitals that do not contract with fully capitated health plans to accept the reimbursement rates established by the department in setting its biennial budget as payment in full from plans. And I assume that those reimbursement rates, since they reference a particular part of the bill, don't necessarily tie it to fee-for-service. It could be to the development of the managed care capitation rate.
Right. That was the intent.
And that, you know, it as, you know, kind of the trade-off for that, requiring hospitals to treat enrollees of fully capitated health plans. Section 13.
A question then.
Representative Mata Sanderson.
Then what is the incentive to get hospitals to accept certain fully capitated health plans if they're going to get the same reimbursement rate whether they accept the plan or not? I mean, if they, I'm not sure where I'm going with this. Do you understand where I'm going?
Representative Cruz might be the better person to answer that.
It's a problem that we've had, and it's more in the Portland area than any place else, because around the rest of the state, what we find is the FCHIP, the hospital's part of the system. But what we're trying to deal with here is the fact that in some cases we would have FCHIPs that might not sign contracts with hospitals, and then so the people that went to the hospitals would be paid fee-for-service rate, which is a lot lower. And what we are trying to do is, by requiring the hospitals to take these people, is to make sure that the reimbursement is at the managed care rate, which is a higher rate, so that there's equity and fairness in whatever the reimbursement rate is trying to be. You get back into the section of the benchmarks and the actuary that comes after that OMAP does. The whole concept behind that is shared pain. Okay, so in other words, I mean, because we set it, we're setting the benchmarks at Medicare rates, except for drugs, which is somewhat convoluted, but with the full understanding that the reimbursement level we will have in the state probably won't reach that, but we didn't want one section of the provider network to be getting more, relatively speaking, than the other. We wanted a level playing field so that every provider segment was contributing a like amount. And so this was part of that. And the assumption was that if we had a fair and equitable reimbursement system, that even the hospitals that weren't under contract should play in that same system.
So just to make sure I understand, if we have a pregnant woman under her Oregon Health Plan, fully capitated health plan,
right,
and really, really wants to deliver at Meridian Park rather than another hospital, and shows up there, it's sort of hard to... Would Meridian Park get paid at the full rate for the delivery of the baby?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay.
That's by design what would happen, although one would assume under the current system, would that be considered emergent care?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Especially with a woman.
Yeah.
Right now...
I thought with a man.
They don't have babies. I'll explain it to you later.
They wouldn't have to pay.
Yeah, they would be. Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know.
Ooh, that was a good movie.
Right now, it was. What the bill says is that reimbursement rate is going to be set by OMAT, basically. And we don't want that to be fallback position of Medicaid rates for that. For Meridian Park, for example, we want that to be a better rate, a rate that's not so high that once again the hospitals won't contract with the FCHIPs. We want to put everybody at risk in this and they get best management we can out of it. Very tricky thing to do. Very difficult. And that's why it's broken down so badly in the metro area. Okay. Your example is really very good. That could happen. And then what do they get paid? A Medicaid rate or something above a Medicaid rate? And that's the question. Right?
Okay, continue.
Section 13, this is the piece dealing with the bifurcated pharmacy benefits manager system, which we understand the intent of that and that it's an option for the fully capitated health plans to use so that they would be able to pool their purchasing power if they chose to do so. The one concern, one particular concern that we have with this is that it requires us, the department, to use the pharmacy benefits manager as opposed to currently we use the pharmacy benefits administrator. And the administrator does not actually pay the claims, and the bill requires the PBM to pay the claims. And right now the PBM is a point of sale. It does all of the prospective review, drug utilization review activities, but ultimately it transfers an electronic claim overnight with no human intervention to our system, Medicaid Management Information System, to actually cut the check. And so this requires something different. It may be an unintended consequence here. I don't think a great deal of discussion has occurred on this section of the bill.
No.
And in any case, this would require, this section of the bill would require us to obtain federal approval to rebid for the pharmacy benefits manager contract and to change our claims processing procedures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Lynn, do you have any sense of how much additional staff you would need?
Oh, related to the infrastructure to support this more complex system. I don't. You know, might be one staff per person. It's just that we expect that the contracting issues will be much more significant as we try to make this work in a way for the managed care plans, which we've never dealt with before, and their needs of the system.
And it sounds like you, if I follow up, you might have to have a different computer system. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there would have to be, as written, there would have to be changes in the computer processing because those claims would now, and payments would now be issued by an outside entity as opposed to our computer system that cuts the checks today.
So your computer system might not be needed at all?
For that particular function. But that's the piece that's easy. That piece is all transparent and electronic in terms of how that works.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Along this issue, I'd like to talk to, we have an opportunity, the FCHIPs, to see how they manage this. They use PBMs. They obviously function the same way you do. They get the claims paid, they get good management, and somehow it doesn't cause them major system changes. You've been doing it a different way than they have. I also note that most commercial plans handle it through PBMs also. We'll have a discussion about that afterwards. I hadn't seen this before, and maybe it's one of the things you should farm out to the plans to take care of this whole thing for you, take it out of your computer. You wouldn't have to have any major changes at all. We can have the F-chips do it for you and save some money for the state. Thank you.
Section 15. This is the piece that deals with going out to get supplemental rebates, and I just note a comment I've made before that we don't expect we would be able to obtain supplemental rebates the way the bill is set up with the management of the drugs being done by the fully capitated health plans. There aren't the incentives that are usually there when you get supplemental rebates from a drug manufacturer. The last comment is on Section 18, which deals with the operational date of the bill. Just want to, again, say that we do have a concern in terms of the operational date being effective October 1st of this year without a contingency component. We're fine working towards October 1, but we're concerned that there's not a fallback place for us if securing federal approval for the changes that require federal approval is delayed, or the implementation of the systems changes or contracting changes are delayed, or possibly if some portion of the bill might not be approved by the feds. We don't see a contingency for that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd point out that the reason we use that date, that there were several reasons. Number one, it coincides with what is now the contract year, coincides with the beginning of the federal fiscal year, will probably coincide with the additional Medicaid dollars we hope we're getting. And there was also the fact that realizing implementation is a little fuzzy at this point in time. It is much easier for us to delay to a date certain implementation. We can't speed up before a date certain. So there were a lot of compelling reasons for that date tying us to the system and the process. Clearly a target we hope to be able to hit on most of this stuff, but just logistically it's easier to back off to a later date because we can't come forward to an earlier date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to add to that. I agree completely with what he said, what Representative Cruz said. The other question here is we do want to keep pressure on to make these changes occur and keep everyone moving forward legislatively and administratively. The question that in my mind is, can if we don't want to put notwithstanding language in this unless it's absolutely necessary. I wonder if E-Board has the right to help us with this. If they aren't able to get the waivers we need early enough, my first thought is they probably aren't. They mainly do rebalances. I'm not sure if they have legislative ability to do that unless we give them something that would allow them to do that. We may want to consider that. The E-Board might have an opportunity to give them relief.
Okay. I think Representative Bates, we discussed this, and it's my understanding that this allows the ability to move further out in time, because we had that discussion in one of our meetings in the library, and I thought Holly was fairly clear on this. So
we'll check.
Check on that.
Perhaps schedule and unschedule funds through DAS and that sort of thing in the E-Board.
I'm more concerned they don't get the waivers in time and can't implement the program. Although CMS has been very open about moving things fairly quickly, faster than we have. So hopefully it won't be a problem.
Any other questions for Lynn?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That ends the witnesses that I've had signed up. Is there anybody present that would like to testify? Ellen Lowe, please come forward.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm here today representing the Oregon Law Center and the low-income Oregonians they serve, who are often members of the Oregon Health Plan. And I would just like to comment on one section, and that is Section 9, which appears to provide a mechanism for bringing the Oregon Health Plan reimbursement into line with what was initially promised in Senate Bill 27. But what I also wish to say is that I have seen some of the materials that have recently come from the actuary. I do believe that there is information on trends and cost and utilization. And so it would be our hope that in addition to prescribing this methodology for the future, this would be a methodology that could be used this session by Ways and Means as they craft the reimbursement schedules that need to be part of the Oregon Health Plan. You may find it strange that a representative for the consumer is here talking on behalf of providers. But without providers, there is no access for the folks that we represent. And as we see some of the trends that have occurred over the last few years, we really believe that you have an opportunity in this session to establish a benchmark. And we ask that you deliver the message, perhaps through Representative Bates, who sits on Ways and Means, but also to all the other members about the importance of having an adequate, up-to-date reimbursement schedule in order to assure access, because without that, there really isn't an Oregon Health Plan.
I think. Any questions for Ellen? Ellen, thank you. I appreciate those comments. It's certainly well taken, point well taken. And we just picked up another signatory, Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Long-Term Care Pharmacy Association. It's the association of pharmacies that supply nursing home, assisted living centers, and like institutions with residential care. I just have a point I'd like to put on the record, because I think it may just be a matter of clarification, not necessarily a change. It has to do with the interplay in Section 10 and Section 13. The provision for management, the administrative services that the fully capitated health plans will provide to include management of prescription drugs for fee-for-service clients, has an interesting impact if we're talking about for the fee-for-service clients who are in institutional settings. Those fully capitated health plans would not, as I understand, have any administrative or oversight work with respect to the other health care services those folks are receiving, but I think, unless there's some clarification, that they might have a role and a responsibility, either they or some fully capitated health care plan from another area, on the prescription drug benefits, and I think we need to try to clarify that. It may be that under subsection 4 of section 10, where it talks about the department shall adopt the rules to implement this section, including but not limited to defining eligible persons who are exempt from the provisions of this section, that may be the place to clarify that issue. And on section 13, I think it's an issue that Representative Cruz and others have already raised, at least as I'm understanding the discussion. The pharmacy benefit manager reimbursement to pharmacies, and in particular institutional pharmacies, I think we'd like to make sure we know how that interplays with the issue of setting the rates of reimbursement, and I think that's an issue that you've discussed a bit previously. So those are two issues to seek maybe some clarification as this moves through the process on those two issues. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have any questions for Paul?
No, just a quick comment. Paul, first off, we're supposed to be at a meeting together at 4 o'clock, and you delayed that meeting a little bit longer. Thank you very much.
I'll leave as soon as you do.
Yeah. The fee-for-service management of prescription drugs is something that, by bifurcation, we've eliminated pretty well. If the institutional institutional patients are primary fee-for-service, by the very system we've set up here, we unfortunately cannot manage them. I think most of the people you're dealing with are probably fee-for-service, or probably Medicare or Medicaid, Medicaid more likely mostly, who are fee-for-service. It's a substantial part of the health plan, but I think if you read the bill carefully, and I'll reread it with you to make sure I'm not mistaken, that since they're in fee-for-service, the FCHIPs will not be managing that part of their care.
Will not be?
Will not be, because we, by federal law, can't get in there and do it. Okay, I frankly would like to do it, but we can't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I appreciate that clarification. I don't think it's a question of whether those benefits should be managed. It's really a question of whether the folks managing the ambulatory care are really in a position to manage the institutional care pharmacy benefits. So
Mr. Chair, that is one question, which I would argue the opposite on, by the way, because I work at all those fields personally on a regular basis. But I think that from your point of view, you're safe. I don't believe that we can have FCHIPs or anybody else manage the pharmacy benefit in institutional care because it's fee-for-service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 3624? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3624 and open the work session on House Bill 3624.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3624.
Representative Cruz moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3624. Is there any discussion? Opposition? Seeing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 3624 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescinding the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Cruz has moved House Bill 3624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended and the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. So now we open up some discussion here.
Why?
Well, I'd like to say something.
Representative Cruz.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Ben, we wish you were here.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, those of you who have been kind of in the inner circle on this have done a phenomenal amount of work, really untold hours, to craft this structure. And I think that this is the type of complicated topic through which each additional pass one finds things to improve and amend, and I'm sure that conversation will continue. But it really is quite a substantial piece of work, and I compliment you on what you've done, and will send it with enthusiasm to the floor of the House.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
I thought
Merkley.
He was going to oppose it for a minute.
Where's Representative Merkley going here?
I was getting ready to dial Representative Morgan. I would like to say that I really am thankful for the work that Representative Cruz, Bates, and Westland and all the work groups have put in on this, as well as staff. I think it's a great piece of work. There's obviously still some minor tweaking left to do, and probably the biggest question of all that is not in our purview is how do we fund the 150,000 people that we have not been able to cover yet. But I think this bill goes a long ways to carrying on the spirit of the Oregon Health Plan. And the intent of the Oregon Health Plan, and if we can find the will to fund the rest of it, we'll be in good shape. And with that, we'll call the roll for the vote. And Kelly?
I'll give it a courtesy. No, I'll give it a yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. And Westland and Miller are also excused. And with that, the motion passes. I do not see any. Oh yes, we have two carriers, Representative Cruz and Representative Bates.
What a surprise!
It's truly a bipartisan effort here today, and probably a unique effort here today. And with that, I will close the work session. And seeing no further business of the committee, we will adjourn.
We've carried things together before, Alan.
Yeah, but it had-